Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 97 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and today's guest is Erica Hall. This episode is sponsored by MailChimp. MailChimp celebrates creativity, chaos, and teamwork. Chaos is kind of a weird thing to celebrate, Erica, don't you think? Kind of an interesting thing. For a company.
I celebrate chaos all the time.
I celebrate chaos. I don't know if I'm a mail company if I want to celebrate chaos. We've sent your mail somewhere else.
No, I don't.
They would not do that. They're awesome. Their generosity is legend. MailChimp, they seem to support everything good on the web, and their product is fantastic. I know Mule Radio uses it, as does a book apart, an event apart. I wouldn't be caught dead sending mail with anything else.
And yes, they are fantastic and admirable. I agree.
I love those people, and they have a chimp. So,
and it's good to have a chimp.
If you like chimps and you like mail, go to MailChimp.com to learn more. So, Erica Hall. Erica Hall is the author of Just Enough Research, The Guardian of Rupert, and the co-founder of Mule Design, a design studio in San Francisco with clients all over the world. Hi, Erica.
Hi, Jeffrey.
So you're on fire right now. Your new book, articles in Wired Magazine and a List Apart, interviewed on the Future Web on the 5x5 network. What am I missing?
I think that's it for now.
New York Times?
No, the New York Times only, they picked up the, one of their blogs picked up the Wired article, but they have not yet independently covered that.
We'll have to talk to them.
We'll talk to some folks over there.
And I understand you're being approached by all kinds of people as a result of the book already.
Approached in a good way.
Yes.
Not people coming off the streetway.
Not like, you know the aliens exist, so we're going to make you disappear, but we, like, perhaps a nonprofit organization that many people have heard of that helps children may have reached out to you for an example? No?
A nonprofit organization that helps children. This is like this awesome guessing game. I have, I've been getting a lot of great email from people. It's really fantastic email and tweets. And I think that Wired piece really hit a nerve. I feel that, you know, out in San Francisco, the startup culture and the venture-backed startup culture is very, very prevalent. And there's a certain philosophy behind that and a certain way of doing things that optimizes for a set of things that I think are very different from what we as designers optimize for, or a lot of people who build products or businesses optimize for. And so I think what I've been talking about over the past week really hit a nerve. I got that sense.
Well, what's your problem with Silicon Valley funding startups nobody needs? What's wrong with companies? What's wrong with companies that make stuff nobody needs, or make stuff that nobody will pay for, getting lots of money?
That's a great opportunity to point out the difference between a leading question and a non-leading question in research. That was an excellent leading question. Yeah, it's really as people who, you know, and I don't want to, you know, tar all entrepreneurs with the same brush, because there are a lot of people who get funding and are doing really fantastic things. One great example, Mandy Brown at Editorially, right? Doing some great useful things with collaborative writing. And a lot of people take funding because it really helps fuel this dream. But there's also a much more cynical, I'd say, side of things where these VCs who have money, and it's cheaper than ever to start companies. And so these folks on Sand Hill Road have a lot of money they want to, quote, put to work.
Sand Hill Road, what is that?
Oh, Sand Hill Road. Oh, yeah, that's a... that is...
Is that Park Avenue? Or is it Madison Avenue? What is that?
It's weirder than that. It's a street adjacent to Stanford University, and to drive by it, you would not know what a seat of power this place was, because it looks like a nice tree-lined, woodsy, bucolic office park. But in reality, virtually every single venture capital organization has an office on this street, on this mile-long strip of road in the middle of these rolling oak tree-filled hills.
How do they take people to lunch? I mean, I'm assuming they're all going to the same five restaurants in an adjoining office park or an adjoining mall, and they're like, oh, she's talking to so-and-so. We just talked to them last week. I mean, don't they see each other? Wouldn't that
be weird? There is one Starbucks. There's a funny little mall, this little supermarket strip mall kind of place that Time forgot right behind there. We stop for coffee there all the time if we're going to see people in the area. And this is the deal makingest Starbucks. It really seems it's in this mall. I think the investors go and have lunch local to where a potential or current portfolio entrepreneur is. So I think they are always out of the office. So their offices are generally quite empty, and the partners themselves are off having lunch with people in other places.
How's the coffee at that Starbucks?
How's the coffee? It's like the coffee at every other Starbucks in the world. So I can
remember being in Silicon Valley in the 90s, like visiting Glenn, the guy who ran Cool Site of the Day and then ran Project Cool.
Oh, yeah.
And like seeing Netscape, like Netscape's office part, and like... And there were all these little like Chinese restaurants and little bookstores and stuff.
You were in Mountain View, right?
I was in Mountain View and all those kinds of places. I imagine it's changed a lot since then.
Well, it's yes and no. I mean, I don't get down there a lot anymore. But Mountain View, downtown Mountain View, is this one. It's one long street. It's called Castro Street, which is totally different from Castro Street.
That's
in San Francisco.
Not the yeah.
No, it is not. It is not the place. Castro Street in Mountain View does contain many dozens of fantastic Indian. It's got some of the best Indian restaurants, great Chinese places, great dim sum. So maybe that's where all these guys are going to lunch to find people to invest in. And yeah, so the issue isn't necessarily venture-backed startups. The issue is the culture of getting the money and just trying something, and not necessarily trying something that you think, wow, this needs to exist. I have this idea. I think it serves a real need. It cures some pain. It'll be a great thing to put out in the world. But saying this is something that I want to try, and you know, maybe we sell it and maybe we don't. And
color
not really caring.
Instead of dodgeball. Like dodgeball and Foursquare are because two people really loved checking in and they just they want to keep going until they get it right. And color because
color.com
entrepreneur
was...
had a good track record, so let's make something. So here's another thing this person's trying.
Yeah, and he tried it with $40 million. And it was this collaborative photography application. This is a great
example.
You'd
go to a bar and be like, wow, someone else was throwing up at this table last month. Right? That's what it was. It would show you who had been at that bar before, or you'd been in a bathroom. You could see who else had been in that bathroom. It was weird. It was like a ghost photography.
But the idea was also photos of the same thing at the same time. So the one of the fundamental issues with this from a user experience perspective was it required to really work as envisioned. It required a lot of people taking photos of the same thing at the same time.
Which would happen naturally because life is a controlled, we have fascist overlords and they could say, everyone at the restaurant, stand up now and use this.
Yeah.
It would never happen.
And it meant that the application was pretty much useless, especially relative to any other photo sharing application or social network that allowed you to upload photos. It was useless and undifferentiated until the point that 100 people were using it. And even then, it was of totally questionable merit because if you're at a concert, do you want to see everybody's pictures of the same concert, which are probably going to be really the same picture?
Or the back of different you know, the back of the head of the person in front of them. So it would be a
yeah.
lot. There was a, I remember seeing computer science stuff again in California in the 90s where I think Microsoft was basically working on this. It was like a Google of the whole world. They were going to have pictures of everything and they were going to be able to link it all together. So basically it would be like Blade Runner, that scene in Blade Runner where he's looking at a photo, but he can, you know, this do
enhance.
The thing you enhance in a way that you could never do with a photo, right? Basically walk through it.
Yeah.
But actually all the photos in the world were going to be collaged together with the science of angles so that it would be like kind of like what we have now with Google.
Yeah, right? Google's
except it was a long time ago. So it sounds like an ambitious idea, but crowdsourcing that, it was like people were going to pay you $1.99 to be part of a crowdsourcing experiment. Maybe.
Yeah, but first the crowd would have to be there. I mean, well, that was the issue. Like, why does one person go there?
To be fair, I mean, you know, the first web was like that. The first bulletin board was like that until there's a crowd. Facebook was nothing until, you know, it became millions of people. And the only reason it's successful in really now is because there's so many people using it, not because it's the best experience, but because so many people use it.
Yeah. So that, I mean, the idea of the network effect is totally legitimate. Like a phone isn't interesting unless one other person has a phone.
Yeah.
But this wasn't adding anything. Like the phone or even Facebook added something that filled a real need for people.
So,
I mean,
yeah. So color, okay, is a good example. It's like boo.com became emblematic of the .com era's failures, right?
Boo.com was an app. We're going way back in time, okay, boo.com.
And many people listening won't remember it, but it was an app. Yeah. It was a website, a shopping website that was so elaborate, it did everything but help you shop. It was like, it sort of, you know, as opposed to Amazon, which was ugly and a cluster cuss in a lot of ways, but it was easy to find stuff that you wanted to buy.
But do we not cuss on this show? I'll make sure.
Oh, no, we can. We totally can. Fuck. I just
want to be clear about community standards before I said something.
On the old network, we didn't swear.
Oh, but now we swear.
Yeah, now we can. We can. So here's
and I like
startups
that
nobody needs.
The startups.
As opposed to research, which is the subject of your book, where you test an idea first before you start spending money. Or you spend.
Well,
is that
not
true?
Necessarily.
No.
Yeah, okay. It's not even that you necessarily test an idea first. It's that you go into whatever you're doing informed. And I found this great, something I quote in my Wired piece is this this guy who founded a dating site in New York, this entrepreneur said, oh, we don't do research anymore because starting companies is what we do instead of doing research. And that blew my mind because starting a company is even if you're doing a lean startup or whatever your methodology is, that's still you're involving a lot of people in that. You're involving you, maybe a co-founder, maybe some employees, or maybe just a team of like three founders or something. But that is a huge investment of personal time and resources.
Sure.
And to just go off and say, we don't know if it's going to work, but we're all going to invest our time in it.
Well, that sounds like a rich person's perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the and that's a perspective that's inherited from people who are sitting on, you know, $500 million or billion-dollar funds to whom giving somebody $1 million to try something is nothing. But my issue with that is what it does is it junks everything up because nobody's really asking the question. And that's step one of research for me is just asking yourself questions. It's critical thinking. It's thinking, okay, I want to do this. What are all the potential objections? And just thinking about those. And do I have a good answer for those potential objections? And is this, how do I know this is something that people even want? And you don't even necessarily have to answer that question. You have to pose the question, which is, how will I know if this is an idea that's worth this time and money to put into the world?
Now you can't,
and just start to think like that.
But you can't ask people. So how do you...
Oh, no.
Right.
Yeah.
That would be the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, you never... Because. And this is why, for a while, people were really quoting Steve Jobs and they said, oh, we don't do research because Apple doesn't do research, which is, of course, complete crap. Apple does a ton of research. They're just incredibly, incredibly secretive and they make it all look like unicorns poop this out. So what you do, you never ever, and Steve Jobs said you can't focus group a great product, right? You won't ask people what they want. If you ask them what they want, you know, you'll be limited by their imaginations. Mm-hmm. So you never ask people what they want because, you know, the average person on the street, they can't envision, you know, something in the future that isn't, it's, you know, you get the horseless carriage thing. That's if you ask people what they want a horseless carriage, or they'd want a faster horse, not a car. Totally messed up that whole car thing.
That's okay.
But you know what I'm saying?
I want my phone to have a detachable SIM card. I want my phone to have better reception. That's what I want. I want, I want an internet device in my pocket. Nobody's going
to
think
that. This tiny computer. Or they'll answer the question like, oh, what should I want? It's like if you ask somebody what's in your Netflix queue and it's all like Schindler's List and films in Esperanto, right?
Right.
If you ask people questions about like, oh, what do you want? They'll either answer something that's like, oh, what can I conceive of given my present circumstances, or what should I want? And neither one of those will guide you. Right. So what
because we went through public school where you learn, I'm good at client services because I was good at public school. I was good at guessing what the answer is instead of finding out. I'm good and bad at client services for the same reason. I'm good at I'm good at guessing what answer they're looking for, and that's the wrong thing to be looking for. You know, I'm good at pleasing.
Yeah.
But that's not right.
Yeah, people in research, they'll be pleasers. Like if you go and you sit down and you have to really account for that when you're talking to somebody. So, but what you really try to understand is what do people actually do and why? And that's the sort of anthropological, ethnographic part of the research.
And you do a lot of that at Mule, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I came out of a really, research-based design methodology where you really try to find out what people actually do right now. Why do they do it? Because then you can use those things, because you might find out that people use the internet in a certain way at a certain time because they have a job that you'd never heard of before that puts, because we're all very limited. Like anybody who works in this industry is super limited in our empathy for other people because we have essentially infinite internet around us all the time as a condition of our profession. And we're usually like sitting at a desk. And so when you think, well, under what circumstances might somebody interact with this product or service? They think, well, they'll always have access to the internet and, and they'll always have some uninterrupted time. They'll be able to do it like in between doing other things because we're always working and, you know, looking at TMZ and seeing what's on RDO. We're doing all these things simultaneously. And then you might even take a leap from that and think, well, other people who make a decent living, who are pretty well educated, will be very similar. But you look at how a doctor uses the internet and they're barely online, you know, and then some other people, very high level people. CEOs might probably, many of them still have their assistants print out their email for them. And so you can't draw conclusions from your own experience. That's very limited. So what you have to do is talk to people who are representative of the type of people you want to be your customers or your users, and just ask them what they do with their day. Like the very best user research of all is just to like get somebody on the phone and say, well, just tell me about a day last week. Just tell me about a typical day. And you hear them talk about what they did and why they did it and how they were interrupted. Like, oh, I keep meaning to get my finances in order, but the kids are always like in my business, or I have a job where I'm on call and at any moment I might have to just get up and run out the door. And that has real implications for anything you're designing, whether it's a digital object or a physical object. And so that's one kind of research, and that's the best known kind of design research. But there were really two things I wanted to accomplish with this book. One was expanding people's ideas of the type of research that they have to do. So it's not just, you know, understanding what the user needs. I mean, that's really, really important if you want a successful product, but you also have to look at the kind of organization you're working in and really understand like, well, what's my capacity to deliver what the user wants? And I think a lot of people don't do that. And that's why you get products that are fantastic, but from a user perspective, like there have been many sort of internet companies and products and services that people loved and people wanted to use, but they were either complete money losers or the organization just didn't have the skills to support it. And so you've got to look at that. And then you've got to look at, you know, what we often call the competitive landscape. And you don't look at that in terms of, oh, who else is doing similar things? That's a very organizational way of looking at it. You have to say, well, how else do my potential customers solve this problem? And they might be solving it in a way that's a really hacky workaround that's really painful to them. And you say, oh, I'm offering a totally better solution. And they might be solving it by, oh, I ask my neighbor, or I do this thing that's totally free that I can do from my sofa. And then that's what you've got to beat with your product. People are lazy and people are creatures of habit. And you have to really start from that. They're not going to change their habits for you. You've got to kind of work in that habit. So that's also another big part of the kind of research you have to do.
So do you ever hang out with people? Not just do phone interviews, but... you know, that ethnographic thing mm-hmm. where you like follow people around and videotape them? Or does that, is that Heisenberg?
Stalking?
Is that Heisenberg where it distorts, when you record something, it distorts what you're recording? It distorts the behavior?
Oh, yeah, the observer principle.
Yeah.
That's not something, I have done that, but more back in the old days. Because the other thing, like my one goal, right now, like with this book and with talking about all of this, is to expand people's concept of what kind of research you need to do. And the other one is to reduce the perceived level of effort with research. Because the reason a lot of people don't do it is because it's tied to this whole user-centered design process, which is tied to this whole waterfall methodology. And people come out and they're like, oh, we're lean, we're agile. So we don't do research.
We don't have time, don't have money, so we're not going to do research.
We're not going to do research. Instead, we're going to sink all of our time and money into an unexamined set of assumptions, which is way more expensive and way more potentially time-consuming because you could just end up sort of flushing all of that.
So you're addressing, in the book, you're addressing designers and UX folks, but you're also really talking to clients. You're talking to site owners, talking to business owners, right? You're talking to people who... Mm-hmm. are about to, you know, goaded perhaps by this Silicon Valley idea that $1 million is nothing to throw away, right? Goaded by that or driven by the realities of a very tight budget, people are just acting on a set of assumptions. How do you, and you're trying to fight that, how do you deal with the fact that oftentimes, like in client services, you go to someone and they've already figured out what they want to build, based on a bunch of meetings that they've had amongst themselves, none of them being the user. Go ahead.
Well, one of a couple things, because sometimes people do come to us and they say, well, we've done research, we've had these meetings, we've done these things. And we'll say, of course, well, we'll take whatever you've done into account, but we have to examine it and we have to prod it, because our greatest advantage coming in from the outside is being able to ask questions that people in an organization can't ask. Like, people in an organization have a hard time saying the emperor has no clothes. Like, if your VP of marketing, your VP of product comes at you and says, hey, I've got budget and I've got this awesome idea, and maybe you're the designer or one of the developers on the product, and you hear that idea and you think, wow, that idea is stupid, or I've seen that idea done, or I have some real reservations about doing that, you're not going to go to that, you know, VP of product and say, hey, I have real concerns about this, even if you have totally valid questions. But if they hire somebody to come in from the outside, like, we can come in and say, why do you think that's a good idea to do it like that? And that won't come across as an insubordinate question. That will come across as, oh, well, that's this high paid consulting we're there to do, is really think hard about these things. And that can be, I think, really frustrating for people, because a lot of times we'll go into a client organization and people in the organization, like on the staff, will know kind of the right way to approach things, but will be constrained by the organization.
What do they do if they can't hire an outside consultant? They're in there. They know what to mm-hmm. do. They, because they're designers mm-hmm. and they're web people, they know that their boss's idea is not a good idea. Mm-hmm. How can they use research tools, affordable research mm-hmm. tools, to sort of without offending the boss, correct this direction of the ship?
Well, step one is to take that, to take the kind of research ideas and the ethnographic ways of working and turn those on that decision maker. The first thing you do before you even go off and gather like potential customer or user research is you say, okay, for starters, like what you want to do is change an idea or behavior for that boss, that decision maker. And you say, why does he or she want to do things that way? And so that you can say, well, I want to change that. So you say, well, how are they incentivized? How are they recognized? Where did they get those ideas? And if you really sort of analyze them like that, then you say, okay, now I know, like my personal designs, if your design problem is how do I get this person to have a different mindset about research, what you say is, okay, what is reinforcing the current bad ideas they have right now? What's that based on? Is it based on, did they read a business book? Is it just one of those like cargo cult kind of like, well, Google does this, so we're just going to take what we see on the exterior of Google and slap it on our product and we'll succeed like Google, which is a very common way of doing things.
Very common.
You see what they trust, you see what their information inputs are, and then you can use that. So you can go off and maybe say, okay, I want to build a case that we do things differently and do things in a way that allow us to build a successful product and not waste a bunch of resources. And you can use what you know about them and the way that they want to be perceived. You know, if they want to look really smart, a lot of times the issue is somebody in that position wants to look like they have all the answers. And when you come in from a research mindset and say the most important thing you can do is say, you know, like Socrates said, I know one thing, I know nothing. And how do you get the person who prides himself on having the answers and being the ultimate authority to be open to not knowing things? And so that's kind of the problem to solve. And it's solvable if you find like, okay, if they're going to feel smarter, or if you can point out, oh, there's a lot of things about design driven business. You know, there's like the designer founders are a big buzzword right now, or design thinking in business. If you can pull out an article in the Harvard Business Review to kind of like ease your way into that, like that's the starter, is to get them on board with the evidence. Because right, it's just evidence-based decision making, which is a smart thing to be doing in business, is not like ego-based decision making or you know, whim-based or superstition-based decision making. And strangely, that can be a hard thing to talk people into, because you have to get them to trust your source of evidence to make decisions based on it. So that's kind of step one, is in that part of the research, is turn the research on your own organization.
Your use of evidence-based decision-making sounds similar to some of your partner Mike Montero's advice in Design as a Job, which I reread last night, A, for fun, and B, because I'd had a tough day where I was kind of in the middle of design and client and seeing multiple sides, and everyone was sort of unhappy. Everyone had great intentions. Everyone was sort of frustrated with each other. And then I reread Design as a Job last night to relax, and I was like, oh, so it's my fault. Basically, that's the, you know, it's my fault. But you guys have influenced each other quite a bit, I would think, although you're coming at the same thing from two different points of view. You're coming at it like, let's get more data. Let's I don't want to do the wrong thing for the site owner or the client, the boss. I don't want to do the wrong thing. I'm going to present them with evidence that makes them feel smarter. That's what you've just said. And Mike says that you're a designer, so you have to remind them that they hired you because you're an expert. Which may be a better way to go if you're an outside consultant. Might be a harder sell for an in-house person. In-house,
right?
Yeah, I don't know why it is. I don't know what the psychology is. It's like the person who doesn't think their own spouse is sexy anymore because it's their spouse. They know that they can get their clothes off, so they're not excited anymore. But like, you hire someone because they're a brilliant designer or a brilliant UX person, and then since they work for you, you start not really caring what they think, and you know, instead trying to figure out what Google does, or how, right?
Yeah, it's weird. Organizations are really weird, and solving the problem around the organization is often, and around the people and the human interaction, is often the hardest part of the design problem.
Sure, you're a therapist, right? In some ways,
yeah. In a lot of ways, it's not, because we're all familiar with the like good design principles, and you know enough cognitive behavioral stuff to know how to design an experience that, you know, decreases cognitive load and makes people feel validated and, you know, sets expectations correctly. Like, we all have enough knowledge that we could probably design something relatively decent that would work, but it's like getting that good design. And I think, yeah, this is something I think Mike talks about in his book, is getting good design through an organization is a whole other set of things. And I think research can also help with that. It won't just help you make a better product for the users, but it will really help you with that overlooked part, which is creating something that solves the user or customer problem that is also sustainable and manageable by this organization. Because, yeah, organizations can develop really terrible habits. I mean, I refer to The Wire, you know, the TV show The Wire. You've seen that, right?
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, if you're... If you're a designer or a developer working within a large organization, like I bet you can watch that show and have a lot of...
Oh, yeah.
You feel like, oh, I'm trying to do something and take individual agency, but this organization is thwarting me at every turn.
Well, you're very optimistic. I mean, I don't even know how you can do what you do and watch that show. I mean, if you watch that show, you can come away with this very pessimistic view that, yes... Life tends toward entropy, and organizations mm-hmm. destroy the very things they're meant to preserve. You know, the police force is there to protect, but ends up mm-hmm. being about protecting the police force and not investigating yeah. a crime. And the mayor's there because he's, you know, the new mayor wants to do good, but he ends up doing bad mm-hmm. because, you know, so organizations.
So we come in from the outside.
Right. You do, but a lot of people reading your book are going to be, how can I do this inside? How can I, mm-hmm. I've got a boss who doesn't necessarily understand or respect design, who's just got this big idea, or I work at a university and we've got all these, and you know, it's a seed of learning, should yeah. be, right? It's everything's like The Wire. Everything's like The Wire.
See, it really is. Everybody, if you haven't, you have to watch The Wire for design.
It's a seed of learning, but, mm-hmm. and also, the first few seasons of wow, what was that show where the kids have to design clothes and make it work?
Oh, Project Runway.
Project Runway, I thought was like as crazy as it sounds. I always got a really I used to watch that with my ex and go like, when our daughter was a baby and she called it fashion, mm-hmm. she'd just go fashion and point at the screen. But I felt like in a completely different way, because they're just pulling mm-hmm. stuff out of their ass. But it's like,
yeah.
This is the creative process. This is the design process, and mm-hmm. stuff works and it doesn't work. And
yeah, and I think everybody should have a Tim Gunn in their head.
Tim Gunn.
Who's saying, you should edit that. You know, whenever you're working on something, it's like the writer's principle of kill your darlings. It's like, oh, you really, you should edit
less. He was never wrong. He would look at something and go, I'm worried about the hips, or I'm worried yeah. about the fringe. And they'd never listen. I'd be like, well, you're off the show now. She'd be like, I know Tim thinks this, but I'm really creative and I'm really, and I'm like, you're screwing yourself.
Yeah. See, that's what it is with people who want to have that creative idea in their own heads and don't want to take external input.
So research can help designers too. Research can help not only to make a better product, but to unthink their own assumptions about, well, I'm creative. I need mm-hmm. fringe because I'm radical. It's like, maybe I'm forgetting who I'm making stuff for and what it's about.
Yeah, I think a lot, it goes back to that ego thing and this having a cult. Like with Silicon Valley, I talk about the cult of failure a lot and how like, oh, failure is the best way to learn. You know, it's one way to learn, but maybe you could not fail. And with designers, it's that, oh, people oppose this. You know, there's been a lot of talk about, oh, genius design. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, it's faster if I just do it my way. And I think people look for these kind of tropes because they reinforce what you want to do anyway. Like, you're comfortable doing this, and it's very uncomfortable to conduct research because you're opening yourself up to being wrong, and you're opening yourself up to somebody else having the winning idea, somebody else having the piece of information that really makes it. And some people can't handle that and they just want to be closed off. And so what you have to do is you have to make yourself through practice bigger than that and realize that you'll be the one with the insight to pull all these things together. And that research, like I heard one guy, I think he was one of the founders of Tumblr or something, who was on a panel, who said, oh, you know, we don't do research because we don't want to have to do what our users tell us to do. And it's like, that's not what research is at all. Research
isn't like,
that's focus groups. But also, no matter what you do, you don't have to do anything because it came up in the research.
Right.
It's just an input. It's just a piece of information. And you can decide that you heard something and it really made a lot of sense. Or you can decide, well, we heard that, but we disagree with it for some reason. We're still going to do this other thing.
That's crazy.
But you have to really listen. Yeah, but it's like people get so wrapped up in this like, oh, it has to be me. And there are all these myths about genius designers.
Right. I'm the designer. I don't need to talk to my client. I'm the designer.
Mm-hmm.
There was, I going way back, and there was a little, at the first heyday of Flash, there was an agency that would like, Sony would say, we'd like a website. And they'd go, fine, we'll take $40,000. And then a couple guys with tattoos, who were sponsored skateboarders, let's say, would work
and
over
had
the
DJ
weekend.
Gigs. Yeah.
And had DJ gigs. Would make something crazy over the weekend and take the $40,000 and go, here you go. And Sony would mm-hmm. go, thank you. Or they would go, I don't like it. If they would go, I don't like it, it'd be like, well, too bad, you're fired. And yeah. corporations desperate to be hip were lining up for this stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and $40,000 isn't a lot of money compared to what they might be spending on a commercial or what they might spend
right.
on a 2-year-long UX driven mm-hmm. project. Which there weren't many of those back then. So this agency was kind of cool because they get the $40,000. They'd pay their tattoo guys a couple grand for the weekend.
And the tattoo guys were like, sweet, this buys a lot of beer.
Right. And meanwhile, the owners had $38,000. And this was the .com era, needless to say.
Yeah.
But yeah. So this is all different from that. But it's not unfriendly mm-hmm. to Agile, right?
Not at all. I mean, that's why the book is so short. That's why I wanted to write this book, because of all this baggage people had associated with research, because of all these conversations we had with clients. And we do not budge, right? We do not work with people if they say, I already know what I want you to make. Then don't pay for us. Then you don't need our expertise.
Hence the name Mule, I suppose.
Hence the name Mule, right? But we just want to make the best use of everybody's time and money. And if you already know what you want to build, like, pay production rates, don't pay strategy rates, right?
So
we've talked plenty of people out of hiring us.
Which is a cool thing.
Yeah, and everybody was happier for it, I think. And we learned that from, you know, taking the jobs that we should have talked people out of hiring us for. That's where the learning happens.
That's one place where failure is good, your own failure. Mm-hmm. When you take a gig that you have second thoughts about and then you learn, I should never do that again. I should never.
Right.
We're not going to get along. I don't like this person. I don't like what they make.
Yeah.
I don't have enough time. It's a lot of money, but it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't listen to that voice because you really need the money or whatever. Those are the failures where you learn.
Mm-hmm.
Like you couldn't have written your book if you hadn't had those failures.
Right. Right, exactly. So I'm not saying that there's no such thing as learning from failure. I'm not saying that you need to overcome a fear of failure, that you don't need to overcome a fear of failure to do something great. Like you do. Everybody is like, oh, I'm so afraid I'm going to fail. I'm not going to try. You know, you should definitely try.
But starting a business with someone else's millions of dollars where you don't really have a good idea and it's not based on any real need, that's the kind of failure you're talking about that kind of sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. And also research isn't something like what I tell people when they're like, oh, do we really have to spend this like what is actually a really tiny amount of time and money? Relative to the potential upside. And I said, well, it's going to save you time. It's going to save you money. And it's going to make everything go better. And, you know, I think they usually get that at some point. And it's also these research techniques are things that you can slot into any process. If you're agile, if you're just one person in a, you know, in your basement, if you've got a large team in an enormous multinational corporation, you can use this stuff. So I wanted to lose all that baggage about, oh, it's ivory tower, it's hard, it's going to take a long time, it's going to require us to have a different process than we have. And, you know, I'll say researchers have done no favors for this, because there are a lot of books out there that are 500 pages long. and I shouldn't really rag on them because I have really good friends who've written some of those books for other researchers.
No, I get that.
But there's no entry point. And researchers, because you know, they have their own issue about like, oh, I want to be the gatekeeper to the research. And the best way to get research done is to involve everyone on your team. Because, you know, one of the things I talk about in my book is nobody, if you're a designer, like it sucks and on a certain level to be handed a research report and say, okay, now like I've gone out and done the smart things. Now you do what I tell you. But if you involve the designer in the research, and I learned this from this guy, Jared Braderman, who was the first design ethnographer I ever worked with, who is awesome. And I worked with him at Studio Archetype, and he involved everybody, and everybody went out and did the fields. Like everybody went to the skate park with a clipboard, right? Everybody was involved in the comparative audits and reviews and all of that. And so that then when, no matter what you did, if you were a brand strategist or a designer or a developer, you weren't being handed a research report. You were working from, oh yeah, I saw that kid like do that thing when he was playing video games. Or I was the one who talked to that woman on the phone and like heard that she had, you know, she was like at work and like her kid was calling on the other line and was trying to get some stuff done. And when you are participating in finding those insights, then you're excited to apply them. But if you feel like you're just following somebody else's orders, you know, and the best written research report is still pretty boring. Like I've written a lot of research reports and it might be useful, and you definitely need to document what you find, but don't silo the research off. That's less effective. And I think researchers want to kind of be siloed sometimes.
We do ourselves the accessibility community can be kind of like holier than now. The standards community can be holier than now. Developers can, designers can be like so twee and so like, you don't understand me. And I mean, there's so many ways that we can silo ourselves off from our colleagues. So yeah, kickoff meetings, involving everyone, all that stuff is a really good antidote to that.
And focusing on the goal, not the process. Like everybody's got their methodology and their process they like, but you don't do something to do a process unless you're an artist, then fine. You're an artist and you're like, my work is my process. But if you're actually trying to accomplish something and you tell everybody like, here's our goal, then you can rally everybody around that goal and focus on the goal and do what's most effective to meet that goal. Don't like get all like, oh, I've got to be lean.
What was the research that led to Unsuck It? Or is Unsuck It art?
Oh, I'll tell you what led to Unsuck It.
Unsuck-it.com for listeners.
Yes. So this came out. It's one of my projects because it all comes down to clear communication. And this is something that goes through all of my work. Like everything that humans do kind of begins and ends with clear communication, especially like any kind of collaborative work. You have to be communicating efficiently and using words that people understand. And again, because of insecurity and ego and stuff, that makes people use these words that just obfuscate their meaning because they feel statusy to say or something like that. And there's a great George Orwell's essay, Politics in the English Language, is I think the foundational content strategy document. Everybody should read it. It's the basis for the Economist's style guide, which is really awesome. But anyway, so all this is kind of background. And then, you know, 2-3 years ago, Jason Santa Maria actually made a comment on Twitter that said, you know, some content strategist should just something like make a website about all of this terrible business jargon. And I was like, I'm totally going to do that. Mm-hmm. And so we started Unsuck It as a way to really shame anybody who's using one of these words.
Adoption and process, video white paper.
Oh, video white paper. And the worst, of course, I think the uncomfortable business jargon is open the kimono.
Yeah, that's nasty.
That's gross. And it's always some guy who's saying it. And it's like, oh, we're going to open the kimono. And it's like, what is that? I looked at the etymology, which is fascinating.
What is the etymology?
And it's, and it has to do with like a Japanese folktale about like showing your sexual organ to the wolf in the forest so that you can have a comfortable dialogue or something like that.
Really?
Yeah. It doesn't make it better when you read about it. And I think most people don't even know the background. And so it just sort of sounds vaguely racist and sexual or like you're, it's a very strange phrase.
I always picture like we're all in the sauna. I don't, I see it more like a bathrobe, like, a bunch of like sweaty business people, like, you know what? Let's almost like everyone's on a retreat together. You know, like it's a team building exercise. No.
Yeah, but then what does the expression mean? The expression means I'm going to show you my genitals.
Yeah.
Right. When you open the kimono, what are you doing? Today.
My eight-year-old calls it junk, which is sad.
Okay.
My
8-year-old displaying the junk.
My 8-year-old. I'm like, God doesn't make junk, but obviously that's not true.
So yeah, so that phrase, people use it, and I just want people to be very intentional in everything they do, and language is the
what
first
about long
place
tail
to start.
Play? That's another one I love.
Oh, long tail.
I've had really smart people I respect say, well, it's kind of a long tail play, which I think means no one wants this.
Yes.
I made this for, you know, like there's a Jeffrey Zeldman doll and my daughter's like, why aren't there more of them? And I was like, I don't know. Cause it was kind of for you and me, right? It was made for two people. It's a super long tail play. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 All those words that just use, there's so many great, real specific words. Just everybody just needs to take a deep breath and not worry about everybody else not thinking they're smart or part of the club or something, and just figure out what you want to do really well for yourself and do it.
I'm glad that you're a writer as well as designer. And I'm glad you wrote this book. I'm glad that you do Unsuck It. Can we, cause we're running really low on time.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about Russell Brand?
Oh, sure. And his recent Hugo Boss Nazi moment.
Yeah. I wished his jokes were better, but I liked that he did that, right? I like that he did that.
Yeah. Did you read his follow-up piece about it?
You linked to it, so of course I read it. And he said how strange it was, like half the room. He could feel half the room laughing with him and the other half the room getting really angry, but it's really about corporate power.
Yeah, it was a really interesting, like Russell Brand is a much more, he's done a couple things in the past year that have really made me take a second, because I was really dismissive of him as like this like weird, gross, jokey British comedian.
Right. But they actually kicked him out.
Media critic.
They actually kicked him out?
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to remember the full repercussions, because really I've got...
Did they take the award back?
The award back. Something got... They kicked him out. Something got canceled. But his whole larger point about the fact that he didn't take this seriously because he thought it was just a stupid media event, but that he realized while he was up there talking that people there took it very seriously. And he's like, but what? There's a carpet on the street and we all walk down the carpet, the special carpet on the street through this weird gauntlet of models. And are you people really taking this seriously? This is just a stupid thing we do that makes it look to the outside world like we're having the best time ever. But it's just a stupid work thing that we have to dress up for.
That, again, reminds me of my daughter who we were at Disney World. And I said, do you want to stay for the parade? She was like, it's hot. I want to go back to the hotel. I said, do you want to stay for the parade? She said, why? It's just people dressed up in costumes, which I thought was great for an eight-year-old. Like, a little sad. Like that the eight-year-old doesn't want to go like, I want to wait for Cinderella. She's like, it's just, you know, she knows it's people working. She knows
If you haven't seen the old Harper's Magazine piece about the people who wear the costumes at Disneyland and like Chip and Dale having heat stroke in the parade and stuff like that,
oh
it's a fantastic
oh my
piece.
God.
Now your daughter's like the best media critic ever.
I know. She's
She's a savvy, smart individual.
She's a good dad critic as well. She's really busts.
Yeah, I get the feeling she doesn't hold back.
She idolizes me, but with that comes a lot of honest criticism.
Yeah.
I wonder how the South Park guys got away with. I mean, they went to the Academy Awards, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they were up for an award for South Park Bigger, Longer, Uncut, or was it an earlier work? They were up for some kind of award for a song they'd written. And
Blame Canada.
They took acid and dressed as women. And,
that's right. Well,
and nobody threw
just,
them out. Nobody threw them out. Maybe the Academy Awards are a little less scary than the GQ Awards. I don't know.
The GQ Awards. Well, I think it's that it's once again, I think everything comes down to this ego insecurity. I think the GQ Awards, because it doesn't like, they have to kind of fight for any attention at all. They have to fight to be taken as seriously as they are.
Mm.
I think that they've got more status anxiety. Because the Oscars, it's not like nobody is going to think any less or differently of the Oscars because it's got this venerable history, because it's, you know, it's the company banquet that everybody takes super seriously and people watch.
People watch those guys.
And that's what you expect from the South Park guys. You're like, you expect this outrageous behavior. So it was on brand for them. It wasn't unexpected.
Well, it was on brand for Russell Brand.
And
when they named him Man of the Year, what did they expect him to do?
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's one of those things where they expected him to be their pet monkey. And he actually, he was not just goofing. He was saying something like what he said was actually true. It wasn't really a joke. Hugo Boss had made Nazi uniforms.
They were very nice uniforms, by the way.
They're very nice. They all look so trim and authoritative.
If that war had been fought just on style, the Nazis definitely would have won. Our uniforms were not as nice.
Yeah. No, the brand strategy was really down. But so I think it was the fact that he said something true and not jokey and was sort of pulling the curtain back on the whole event to just say, like, this is ridiculous. And I think nobody was ready. People were simultaneously, they wanted it to be very lighthearted, but they also wanted to sort of take the concept of the GQ awards seriously. So I think it was on a couple levels.
They wouldn't have minded if he'd made fun of himself.
Or if he'd made fun of like an approved target.
Yes. Yeah.
But he, because Hugo Boss was like the sponsor or something.
Yeah,
right?
You don't do that. I gotta say, we don't have Nazi sponsors at like our conference, but also, if
somebody got up on stage and made a comment about one of the sponsors.
Actually, they do. Yeah. Microsoft is often sponsored the show, and they are routinely the butt of jokes, and they sort of expect it. So you never know. You know, you are so great, and this has been so much fun, but somehow our hour has flown by. So I need to let you go with your busy day. Thank you for making the time.
Yeah, thanks. This has been a great conversation. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. You're fantastic. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, MailChimp,
MailChimp,
for loving chaos and sponsoring the show. And we'll see everybody again real soon.